You're listening to Tech Talk Radio in your backyard and worldwide on the pod.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
It's the first time that Apple have actually decided to tell people about something that they're developing.
High-speed broadband, let's just make sure that we can get it in Australia this year, not next.
The three main spamming countries are the United States, China and South Korea.
And I've got some residual powers.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Senator Coonan, the voice of reason.
There's a couple of systems on a gantry that's actually based on a military missile tracking system.
You put the date on ePray, and you get a whole service just on
it. How does it go?
IE7, you were having trouble installing it because you had a genuine copy of Windows that wouldn't validate properly. What did you have to do to get past that?
Built a new machine.
But how hard can it be?
Well, it's not hard at all.
At the end of the day, the photography is all about the person's eye and what they see.
If you find something that's inappropriate about your child, you need to do something about it because it will not go away.
On air, on the internet and on the pod, you're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to the final instalment of the Tech Talk Radio Summer Series for this year. I'm Graham Callaghan, and I can tell you we're all really looking forward to the return of the live show in just 1 week's time on the very radio station you're listening to now, as well as on the live streams and, of course, the podcast. And there'll be no shortage of tech to talk about. Of course, there's last week's decision by Federal Communications Minister Senator Stephen Conroy to force Telstra to keep the CDMA mobile phone network running until the 28th of April, despite Telstra's plans to close it on the 28th of January. Although the Minister conceded that the new NextG network's footprint is equivalent to the old CDMA network, coverage was only equivalent when using an external antenna. The government is concerned that certain consumers who are heavily reliant on the CDMA network may not have had access to the necessary NextG equipment in time to migrate to the NextG network. Telstra have since announced various initiatives to help users migrate and to further improve the new network. The high-definition format war continues with another major movie studio, Warner Brothers, moving away from HD DVD to Blu-ray. Toshiba has responded by again lowering the price of their HD DVD players and improving the Player Plus Disc bundles on offer in an effort to get as many HD DVD players into homes as possible in the hope of keeping their format alive. The Australian retail price of one model has dropped to $299, while the high-level player now comes with up to 11 discs for $599. With the 11 discs worth around $440, this deal may just persuade customers to take a chance on the HD DVD format. If not, HD DVD may join Beta Video's 8-track cartridges and cylindrical records on the list of format war runners-up. So be sure to tune in next week to hear the panel's take on all these issues and much more in the world of technology. But now to today's show. Perry Vlahos is an astronomy educator, author and broadcaster with both a real passion for astronomy as well as an encyclopedic knowledge of the night sky. As Vice President of the Astronomical Society of Victoria, he often runs tours of the night sky for the general public, as well as educating people on how to use telescopes and other equipment and even helping teachers to teach astronomy better to students. He joined Andrew and myself on the panel back in March of 2006.
The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And Perry Vlahos joins us here in the Tech Talk Radio studios. I guess let's start off tonight and talk about astronomy in general. Popularity in astronomy is it good at the moment? How's it? Are there many people interested in this sort of thing?
Extremely popular. Yeah? Of course, it's a cutting-edge science that uses lots of high-tech equipment, but at the same time, it's also one of the few sciences that amateurs can actually make a substantial contribution to without any of the high-tech materials and equipment that's required. So it spans a very wide and broad spectrum of interest there, and it's easy for people to get into. After all, it doesn't cost anything to look up at the sky.
No, that's true. That's true. So astronomy starts by standing in the backyard on a starry night with a book or maybe even a computer or connected up to the internet, maybe online. Is that how it sort of starts?
Well, not really with a computer connected to the internet, because there's a problem there. One of the main problems with astronomy, certainly from backyards and in any populated urban areas, is light pollution.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got a laptop there with It's screened or lit up. It's doing exactly the same thing as all the lighting around the place. So the problem with lighting is that lighting makes your pupils close down if it's bright white light. And so that takes a while again for the pupils to open up to their widest to be able to see the faintest objects in the sky. So, as I like to say, the natural enemy of the astronomer is the electric lamp. So, no, you don't want to take a computer outside and use it with you unless you can make the screen very, very dim and very red, because red is the colour that least affects our eyes. That's why astronomers have red torches.
Okay. And you might presumably print out your star chart from the computer before you go and take it on paper.
That's a good way to do it. Print it out and then take a red torch with you. Now, to make a red torch, it requires some very high tech stuff.
Oh, yes.
Some red paper.
I'm thinking it's a bit of sticky
rubber
tape.
Band to
sticky tape.
Well, rubber band over the front of it to keep it fastened on, and it becomes a red torch, but not a bright red torch. It still has to be dim. So, cellophane is not much good, and paper, a number of layers over the front of it.
Okay, good tip. So, you head out there into the backyard with your star chart and your highly modified torch. So you look up in the sky, what do you see, apart from stars?
Well, depends on where you are. If you're in a suburban area, you're not going to see very many things. If there's a lot of light pollution, you'll see the brighter stars, which may only number as many as 20 or less.
Yep.
And you'll see some of the brighter planets as well.
Which planets can you see?
With the naked eye?
Yeah.
You can see Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, plus one more, Earth.
I'd have to look down for that one, though.
It doesn't matter where you look, you still see it.
That's the trick question on the test, I can imagine that. Okay, so some, because you walk
Actually, Graham, I'll take you up on that one, because no, you don't have to actually look down to see Earth either, because you can see the shadow of the Earth being projected into the atmosphere once the sun goes under the horizon. So you can still look up and see evidence of the Earth being there.
Fair enough. All right, I stand corrected.
But it's in the eastern sky, directly opposite where the sun is in the west. It's an interesting effect. It looks like a sort of purpley-bluish hue going over across the atmosphere, and it's well worth looking out for if you're ever in a area where there's a low horizon and you can physically see the Earth.
That is a horizon without mountains or anything like
or
that.
Or trees and houses
out,
and
out north of Victoria, or even out the Tablelands of Queensland or something like that.
Anywhere where it's flat.
How far out of town do you need to get to a point where you can see interesting things in the sky?
We have a dark sky site, which is about 150 kilometres north of Melbourne, just over the Great Divide, about 20 kilometres out of the township of Heathcote in central Victoria. Now, you don't have to go that far. Basically, you can get away anywhere within half an hour of the outer suburbs, should start revealing the fainter objects in the sky, like the Milky Way, for example. I don't know whether either of you can ever remember seeing the Milky Way from the city.
Well, you can see it.
Not from the city. I think it was...
You can see it.
A long time since you would have seen the Milky Way. Now, one of the great pushes in the society is to see if we can get lighting that's a little bit like the one you've got over there, actually, Andrew, on your left, where it's pointing down and it's not going sideways and upwards because it's got a shield over the top of it. So it's not that we want less lighting, but better and more effective
lighting.
Point it
down, don't let it go
everywhere. And not going sideways and upwards.
That would be more energy efficient as well if you've got the light directed to where you want to use it.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Graham.
So it makes sense on a number of fronts.
Less wattage is being used, smaller bulbs, less electricity, greenhouse gases, coal, etc. Makes a lot of sense. Mm. Money.
So if you come along to your local astronomy club, what would you expect? Do they all sit around at night and with the overhead projector and talk about, let's go out and look at this? Or what goes on at a local astronomy club?
Well, it depends on what level of meeting you go to. Mm-hmm. If it's a general meeting, that's basically a few talks. I do a sky for the night where we use computer simulations using planetarium programs projected up, and people can see what's in the sky over this next month that they can go out and have a look at. But it's not generally something where it's nice and informal and people can come in and say hi and meet them and whatever.
Yeah.
It's more of a formalized type of meeting, and it's not a good one for new members to go to, although sometimes we have some very interesting guest speakers. The better things to go to are nights when we're doing what we call astronomy for the people, where we take large portable telescopes out into the community, whether it be in a park or like last Friday where we took some telescopes down to Brayside Park, or whether it be something like where we go to the top rooftop car park of Victoria Garden Shopping Centre. And have
I've heard you do that,
Have people come up and have a look at that. That's probably the easiest way to get into astronomy in terms of being able to look through a large telescope and getting information from members that are in charge of that particular telescope.
Okay. All right. Now, let's say I come along to one of those events and I go, wow, this is for me. I really want to get something so I can stand in the backyard or take portable or something. I'm not sure. How much is it going to cost me to get in to buy a small telescope? And do you get value for money with telescopes? Are there like pros and cons that you got to be wary of when you're buying something like that, or will just a good old set of binoculars do the trick?
Your last one is the best way to start, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Binoculars are cheap, they're easy to handle, they don't take a lot to be able to know how to focus them and hold them up to the sky. I mean, they're so easy, even a footballer could use them, you know. It's just dead simple stuff. So are there any footballers listening? I apologize and I change it to cricketers or rugby players. So you can change that to whatever you like. And, of course, if it's cloudy, you can always take them to the footy or the cricket or the beach or
so you get a bit of extra
watching.
Use out of them.
Yeah, you certainly do. And I would suggest don't spend more than about $150 on a pair of binoculars.
Yeah.
Save your money for when you're ready to buy a telescope. But binoculars give you great views of the sky in much more detail than what you would ever acquire with your naked eye. Plus, you'll be able to see craters on the moon with them. You, if you can hold them steady by
balancing
them.
That's the trick, isn't it?
Yeah.
Lean up against something solid or something.
Yeah, the roof of a car or the bonnet of a car, putting your elbows on them while you're holding them. Some binoculars also come with screw holes that you can mount on a camera tripod.
Yeah.
That's a good trick.
And that becomes very,
very steady.
So there's
a good tip. If you're buying binoculars, make sure you can mount them on a tripod. That'd be great, wouldn't it?
See that they've got a screw hole in the bottom.
That's the trouble I always have with binoculars, is can't hold them still.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, there's a solution for everybody that wants to do that. And once you can hold them steadily enough like that, you can even see the moons of Jupiter.
Wow.
Yep.
Can't see the rings of Saturn, but you can see
moons
of Jupiter.
I've seen Jupiter moons through binoculars, through Dad's binoculars, and it's a fascinating sight. It really is.
They look just like little
tiniest little pinpricks.
Of light,
yeah, just
right
around the bright.
Yep, the object that is Jupiter in the center. So that would be my suggestion for people wanting to get into it. Get the binoculars first of all. Learn the sky. Find out what some of the brightest stars are, what some of the main constellations are, and how you can use a sky chart. That's really, really important.
And that's something that the club would help out with.
Yep. I actually run some courses on for people learning how to read charts, and we call it observing the constellations, where we take them out to a park, give them a chart, they can bring along their binoculars and their red torches, and I'll pinpoint where these objects are that are in their charts and how to use them, which way
to
turn
them,
where they have to be facing, etc. And with a very bright green laser pointer, I point out the constellations and brighter stars. Now, this green laser pointer goes out for about 2 kilometres into the sky. And
you take planes
very,
out with it,
very easy. Well, no. It is a dangerous weapon. And, in fact, in Victoria, they're banned. You have to have a licence.
Oh, really?
In fact, I'm only one of two people that has a licence to use one of these things.
Okay.
Because they are prohibited weapons and they have as much as 30 milliwatts of power. the one that I use for people to be able to see it in areas that are light polluted, you need something fairly
And you'd
strong.
Be able to get onto that course by through the website again, would you?
Yep. People through can send me an email directly to me if they like, and it's Perry, P-E-R-R-Y, at asv.org.au.
We're talking about learning the sky. So once you've learnt the sky, obviously it's a dynamic, ever-changing sort of thing, I guess, with visiting...
But in a finite sense, actually, Andrew, because the seasons repeat themselves after a year.
Okay.
Now, the planets may have moved their positions along because they're constantly travelling eastward in their orbits around the sun. So for us, they also appear to travel towards the east in our sky. And they keep moving, but the planets are so bright that most of the time you can't actually miss them.
And they don't twinkle that much, do they? Unlike
a
star does.
They're very steady because they actually have some angular diameter, whereas the stars do not have...
The point of light.
Yeah. And the only reason we can see them is because they're so bright that our eyes can't ignore them, not because they have any angular diameter whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep, get to the sky is a finite thing. Get to learn it and also do some reading up on astronomy so that when you do finally have a look through a telescope or you're thinking about having a look through a telescope, what you see doesn't come as a great surprise or a disappointment or mm-hmm. whatever, mm-hmm. so that you know what you should be looking
for. I think that's the key to it really, isn't it? Because you go out there and you look up, especially if you're out in the countryside somewhere, and you see this magnificent array of, you know, stars in front of you, but you're just not quite sure which one's which. And I think a little bit of knowledge, once you get out there, you can go, oh, that's such and such, and that's such and such. And
yes, exactly. Having a telescope is great, but what are you going to look at?
You've got plenty to see with the naked eye, haven't you?
Yeah. So you need to know what you're going to look at before you get the telescope.
Perry, we'll be back in just a minute. We'll talk about all sorts of other things like the Hubble and radio astronomy and things like that. So if you're listening to us, stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Tech Talk Radio wants your feedback. Call the Tech Talk Radio feedback line or visit our website and tell us your thoughts on the show. Tell us your likes and dislikes, your technical dilemmas and program suggestions. Call 1-300-664-882 and leave a voice message. That's 1-300-664-882 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au, and click on the feedback link. The panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. You're with Graeme and my good self, Andrew McComb. And on the other side of the desk, our special guest this evening is Perry Vlahos. He's in from the Astronomical Society of Victoria. And as we got chatting before, Perry, let's stick to our initial plan to talk about magazines and books and things like that and websites. Where should someone sort of head off if they're in the general sort of, I just want to learn a bit more about it? Where should they go?
We're very fortunate at the moment, Andrew, because with the advent of the internet, there is so much information on astronomy that I'm sure your whole life you couldn't go through it all. And there's many, many good websites to have a look at. But I might just point out a few for the listeners out there that may get them started. First of all, the Astronomical Society of Victoria website, which is www.asv.org.au. And that will let them find other links that are relevant to us here locally.
Yeah.
And as the ASV is the largest astronomical association in the Southern Hemisphere, we've got nearly 1,000 members and lots of different groups and different happenings that are occurring within the societies, which basically means that you can do something with the ASV on almost every night of each month. You know,
okay.
There's something going on somewhere.
Yep.
So that's a good one to begin with. There are other links from there to local telescope shops, other societies if you're out in the countryside or whatever.
Yep.
Now, if you want something physical that you can hold in your hand, I would suggest for starters, for charts, the best website to go to is www. I should just say
just W's, yeah.
SkyMaps, one word, skymaps.com. Now, that's run by...
Is this an Australian site?
It's actually run by someone from South Australia, Kim Thalassoudis, which is a friend of mine. And he probably does the best web-based charts that you can find anywhere.
Wow,
he does one for the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah.
He also does one for the Southern Hemisphere.
Okay,
now, what you do is you can download it as a PDF, print it out, and then go outside. There's also information on what is being displayed on the chart on a second page, which tells you what the objects are and how far away they are and that sort of thing.
Is there an instruction guide or user guide on how to read the maps on there for those that have never been there before?
There is, Andrew, but it may not be terribly obvious to everyone first up. So I'll say a couple of things for anyone that does go to that sort of website. First of all, make sure that if the chart is a round chart, that whatever direction you're facing in the sky, that direction is at the bottom of your chart, because you can move the chart around like a clock face. And so if you're looking to the south, make sure that the chart is turned with south at the bottom.
Okay.
If you're looking to the east, make sure that the bottom of your chart says east. So you keep turning
down the
chart.
Bottom. Yeah.
And never look past halfway in any direction. So never go past halfway in the center of the chart.
Okay.
If you need to go past halfway, which means you're looking at the opposite direction, you need to face that direction and turn the chart
around. So halfway straight up, basically.
The zenith, the point directly above your head. And that's usually designated in the chart by just a small plus sign.
Yeah. Now, do these charts update regularly or
how
often?
Oh, yes, there's one for every month.
Okay, so it's monthly type sort of update.
Yep, exactly. So you can download one every month and you can use it for that particular month and it'll be perfectly accurate. Now, other things, some good magazines that people can find in their newsagent if they want to go in there and get something can physically hold in their hand. Australian Sky and Telescope is probably the best one locally. And I'm not saying that because I write for them, but because it really is the best one for Australia. There is another magazine, and you can compare the two if you like, called Sky and Space, which is also another Australian publication. There are some international ones. The only one I would recommend is Astronomy Magazine, which comes in from the US.
Okay.
That's a very good magazine because it also has a Southern Hemisphere chart for us here.
Because I was going to say, is it very Northern Hemisphere-centric as well? Or?
Well, most of the information in there is based on the Northern Hemisphere, but it does have a chart for the Southern Hemisphere, and also because sometimes it takes a little while to get here, the Southern Hemisphere charts is for 2 months ahead. So if you get the February edition, which is probably in the newsagents now, it will have the April Southern Hemisphere chart, right? Which we'll need in a couple of days or something.
All right. Now, you were also talking during the little break about cheap telescopes. You were going to recommend a...
Very fortunate these days, and unlike what it used to be 30 or 40 years ago, or even 20 and 10 years ago, we now have the proliferation of what we call Dobsonian telescopes.
Yeah, now, so what's a Dobsonian telescope?
Well, a Dobsonian is one that was made popular by John Dobson.
Okay.
John Dobson is a story in himself. He is 90 years old. He was out here about the middle of last year around about then, and he had his 90th birthday while he was here with us. The last time he was out here, he was here in 85, and he stayed with me for a couple of nights and my ex-partner, and he was 80 years old, and he had brought along his 15-year-old son. If you're a man out there, I say do the math and weep. But he used to be a monk for a long time.
Really?
And that's when he came up with this idea.
You have plenty of time to study the stars when you're a monk, really, don't you?
The Dobsonian telescope came to fruition then.
Okay.
Which means it was a large aperture, large mirror, cheap to make and easy to use telescope that he used to wheel out into the streets of San Francisco and show passers-by the sky.
Yep.
But unfortunately, the abbot was a little bit annoyed and he said, you've got to make up your mind. You've got to either be here or be out there.
Can't do both.
it decided to leave. But so these telescopes... Sorry, Grant.
So these are the ones that they're a big round barrel type thing and you look in the side of them. Is that these are the ones?
Exactly.
Okay.
With which look a little bit like a cannon. They basically go up and down and around and around. And so just exactly like a cannon. I think that's where he got his idea from, you know. So... and the glass that he used to grind these mirrors...
He made his own glass.
His own glass, but from the glass that was cast...
Because that's an art in itself, isn't it?
Portholes in ships that were decommissioned after the Second World War.
Oh, really?
He got the portholes and ground them cheaply because they were there in US Navy and Army surplus stores and made the mirrors cheaply. And had these.
Why that glass? Telescopes. Like, was that glass just the way they made it? It was a quality glass, or why did he choose old portholes? Or the old glass from the old portholes?
No, just as good as any other.
There's no real reason. It's just available
and cheap.
Okay.
So he could buy one for a few, $2 or $3, and make a cheap telescope. Okay. And the rest of it is all wooden and very easy to move around, and absolutely the easiest thing to use. I cannot stress that the Dobsonian telescope is without any peer whatsoever in the ease of its movement and use.
Yep.
And you can get large apertures now relatively cheaply. Even though they were originally supposed to be made by the user themselves, now factories have gotten onto them. And we get very cheap ones now in from China. And you can get...
What's the glass like? Is it good?
Yeah, the quality is reasonably good.
Yeah.
And you can get a cheap one now for around about an 8-inch glass for about $600. A whole telescope... mounting, tube, a couple of eyepieces to go with it, and a finder scope on top of it.
Okay.
8-inch diameter, which is enough to be able to see most things that you'll want to see.
Can you see galaxies and things like that?
From a dark sky, yes.
Okay.
Although, Andrew, if anyone out there is thinking they're going to see galaxies with big spiral arms and
you're going to be sadly disappointed.
They will be sadly disappointed. It takes a very large telescope to show spiral arms. But not only that, you also need to train your eye to see better and your mind to work better with your eye. So I've had experiences where I've climbed to the top of a ladder of a large telescope and thinking, wow, you know, these, I can see the Horsehead Nebula really well tonight, easy to see and well defined. And someone would come up the ladder after me, look in the eyepiece and go,
Where?
Yeah. So you need to teach your eye to also how to observe.
So that goes back to the learning the sky and using the binoculars to start off with and then buying a telescope like this later on.
So, well, you can buy a telescope like this a little way into it, but don't expect to see as much as you can see later on. Because it'll take a while for you to train yourself and your eye to be able to see better.
And this is where you keep going back to the club meetings and doing
exactly. And hanging out with other astronomers.
Well, that's the thing. It's the group, isn't it? Brain. Yeah. Sit down and have coffee and a good chat and work out what the deal is.
Exactly. Or also going to some of the nights that we have out in the parks or to our dark sky side as well.
And my last question, the iridium flares. They seem to be a good talking point because these things bounce off the atmosphere quite regularly. What are the iridium flares?
Well, they don't bounce off the atmosphere.
They fly past. No, what do they do?
The iridium satellites fleet was sent up about 10 years ago now to aid in phone communications, but not the sort of phone that you would have in your pocket, but rather these large phones that you would take out into the desert or Antarctica or in the middle of the Pacific.
Those big clunky satellite phones.
Yeah, the big satellite phone. That's a good way of putting it, Graham. But unfortunately, the cost was so prohibitive for people to actually use it that the company went broke.
They did, and they couldn't sell them, could they?
They spent about $5 billion sending up this fleet of about 70-odd satellites.
Wow.
And then they sold them all for about $7 million. To a small company that kept them afloat. The satellites themselves have three very shiny panels on them, highly reflective.
Mm-hmm.
And it's these panels, about the size of a large front door, that catch the angle of the sun at certain times and
reflected back down onto the Earth. And if you're on the footprint of that reflection, you get to see this satellite, which starts very, very faintly, then getting brighter and brighter and brighter,
yep.
Sometimes much brighter than the planet Venus, in fact, and then fading down again to something that you wouldn't even notice. And that's the iridium flare that we see.
Okay. And they're so bright that you can even see them in daylight hours.
Can you really?
If you know where to look, you can see them. I haven't seen one yet, but if you really know where to look.
But certainly early in the evenings, you can see them even in metro areas.
Anywhere.
But you have to be in the right spot.
Yep.
Because it might not, in the west of Melbourne, might not see the same view as the east of Melbourne.
No. And Graham, what you need to do then is to get onto a website called heavens-above.com.
Oh, yes.
And at that particular site, you put in your suburb or your town, or if you like, just Melbourne.
Yep.
Even though you can find one for Burwood, you can just put in Burwood, do a search on their database, and Burwood will come up.
Yep.
And then you go back and you look under ISS, which is the International Space Station, or Iridium Flares, and they'll tell you
what time and when
and where.
Yeah, yep. Good.
In azimuth, which is around the horizon, in starting from north, so 90 degrees would be east, 180 south and whatever,
mm-hmm.
and latitude, which or altitude, which is also displayed in degrees from north to 90, 90 being the point directly above your head and north being the point at the horizon. Okay.
Fantastic.
Good. Perry, look, thank you so much for coming in, having a chat to us this evening. It's been absolutely fantastic. I, for one, will be coming along to one of these meetings because one of those things I've always been interested in but never know quite where to start. But now I know. So, Perry, thank you very much. We can contact your organisation through the website, asv.org.au.
Certainly can. And if people want to send me an email directly, it's Perry, P-E-R-R-Y, at asv.org.au.
Fantastic.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Subscribing to the Tech Talk Radio podcast is so easy. It's child's play.
Podcasting's so easy, even my little brother can do it.
Step one, visit the iTunes Music Store and search for Tech Talk Radio in the podcast section. Step two, click subscribe and you're done. Now every week, you'll be able to listen to Tech Talk Radio whenever, wherever, and however you like. You could be mowing the lawn, on a train, in a car, on a plane, at work,
visiting the relatives, washing the car.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
And that you are. We're back. Welcome back, everybody. And one of our guests in this evening is Brian Ackley. Now, Brian has... I know. What do you do for a living, Brian?
I work as an electronics engineer for a company who does data radio products.
Okay. Nothing to do with batteries, obviously. But have a very a good interest in batteries just because of the equipment that you guys made. You want to try and get the length of operability, I guess, maximize
exactly
it
right. Yeah.
Out of your batteries. Now, we've all done the big sort of like, which battery should I buy for which device? And, of course, this day and age, everybody uses batteries, from the smoke alarm through to the digital camera and things like that. So, and we've got rechargeable options. We've got, you know, different technologies, you name it. They're all out there. And I guess that's one of the reasons why we thought you'd come in for a visit and tell us what the differences is between these batteries and rechargeables and things like that, and why some are better than others. So if you walk into the supermarket, as most people would probably buy their batteries there, you're normally confronted with this wall of things hanging in front of you, which some are silver, some are red, some are black, some are strange colours that you've never seen before. On average, what type of, like, your traditional, and let's use brand names here, like your Everready's and your Duracell's, what type of technology are those batteries?
They're all alkaline. Those ones that you mentioned, the Duracells, the...
So would there be more alkaline hanging on the shelf than there would be any other technology?
There tends to be, yeah. The ones that are sort of falling out of favour more these days are things like the Everready Reds and Blacks, you know, the so-called heavy-duty batteries. They really don't cut the mustard these days. They're they're okay in devices which are fairly light duty, but when you look at it, they don't really give you that much in value for money if you've got something that you're, like, say, for example, your smoke alarms and so forth.
Mm.
If you use them in that, they have a fairly high self-discharge and they don't tend to last very long,
mm-hmm.
whereas an alkaline battery will give many, many years of useful service in that application.
So with something like that, we're talking about, even though it's got a light duty, like the smoke alarm, the shelf life of an Ever Ready Red or a Black, which are like your carbon something, your
zinc carbon,
zinc carbon batteries, isn't as good as an alkaline. So you're still better to go for the alkaline.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so in my view, from what I've seen with doing discharge tests on them, that certainly seems to be the case.
Speaking of storage, do any batteries or any technologies last longer sitting in the packet in the shelf in the kitchen?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. The lithium probably are about the best when it comes to that. The lithium, I mean, there's a reason for why they cost as much as they do.
And they are an expensive battery. They're probably about...
They're about $10 for a pair, roughly, the supermarket prices. So
that's about four times the cost of your standard alkaline or something?
It'd be probably four or five. Yeah, okay.
So quite expensive.
Yeah. An alkaline, for example, would probably have... They tend to have a bit more self-discharge. And I know on the side of them, they say some of them have, like, you know, usable until 2011 or something like that.
Okay.
But you won't get your full capacity out of them at that date.
So what was the worst battery you tested? Let's start off at the bottom and work our way up.
Okay. My favourite classic worst battery.
I'm going to have a guess here. Is it Kmart? Is it Kmart brand?
No, it wasn't a Kmart brand.
You got it from a $2 shop.
It was a $2 shop battery and it was called a Rotasonic.
Rotasonic.
Yes, it looked like a Duracell. Exactly. It had all of the same label. It even had the battery tester on the side of it.
Same colour scheme and all
that. Same colour scheme, except the battery tester didn't have anything in it. It was just the picture of the battery tester.
Just a picture of a battery tester. I've seen them before.
Yeah.
Oh, that came out of China, I reckon.
Yeah.
So you didn't go back and buy a second one, just thought, this can't be right.
No, I went back actually a couple of months later and I noticed that they'd changed their brand name. It looked exactly the same, but they were called a Keneng battery after that. And funny enough, I bought a set of them because, like, you know, $2, well, it's not much to have to worry about. And I was
all
curious.
All in the name of science.
All in the name
it?
Of science, yeah. Yes. And I put them in, and yes, I got the whole, I think, 1 minute of discharge out of it as I got with the
Rotasonic. 1 minute?
1 minute.
Now, this is on the standard test that you did on all the batteries.
That's on the standard test I did with all batteries.
Yeah.
Where in this particular stuff, on a fairly heavy load drain, most batteries worked out to be about $1 per hour.
Yeah.
These ones. Effectively worked out to be $20 per hour.
Wow.
So they don't really make a lot of...
And they were the cheapest to buy as a pack of two.
They were the cheapest to buy.
Four.
That's exactly right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that company's got a good margin if they can get the volume of sales up, I guess.
Well, that's how they make their money. I mean, people would buy them thinking that they were really cheap and they do the job. But in actual fact, it's going to cost people like $20 per hour to actually use this brand.
That's right.
That's how they're making money.
Yep. Let's move up the scale a bit. How did the average, like, as a shopper, you probably... Everyone in the course of time would have bought the Ever-Readys,
yep.
Just because they're a brand name and everyone's sort of used to that. How did they fare?
They were not too bad. They probably, well, the Energizer on my list ended up being about number three.
Well, that's pretty good.
They're best. What about the Ever-Ready Red and Black that we see in the super heavy duties and the super heavy duties?
Well, that was quite interesting, actually.
Because a lot of people that buy those because of the brand and that they've been there for so long. You think they've been there for a while, they've got to be good. Are they?
Well, not really. They're not an alkaline battery anyway. They're good for low drain applications.
And they're cheaper in the shops.
They are cheaper in the
hanging
shops.
Hanging up against the other ones.
The interesting thing was that the heavy duty and the super heavy duty, you'd get the idea that the super heavy duty would be a lot bigger capacity, much, much better. Well, as it turned out, when I did the tests, the super heavy duty, the more expensive one, died before the heavy duty one did.
So, you got the wrong packet.
That one had a long shelf life.
Yeah.
Well, let's hope so. Otherwise, we're all getting ripped, aren't we?
Yeah. I wonder how they justify their marketing in that case. I wonder if, like, that's obviously not an isolated example, Brian, because you've done a long scientific test here.
It's all single uses. I mean, you've got to take into account that these are one-off purchases, more for interest's sake than a thorough sort of exam, like buying, you know, 10 different ones of different use-by dates and all that from all over the place and doing a properly averaged result.
So it might have been a slightly skewy test result.
It could have been. Yep. But it was, the interesting thing was that, you know, although one sort of seemed to be a bit better than the other, they both seemed to have roughly the same result. I mean, they were in the middle of the pack. There was a big difference between them, the $2 shop batteries, and the alkalines.
All right. And the next battery, I guess, would be interesting to know is the pink rabbit thing that runs around. And then there's the Energizer. How did that one shape up in the test?
The Duracell, I'm going to have to look at my list now, actually ended up being about middle of the lot. They were quite good. The one that really shone out, which was interesting, was the Duracell Ultra. They've got a new version of it. I'm not sure what the difference is in chemistries or so forth, but they seem to be head and shoulders above the rest as far as actual capacity and length of time. The one that was a bit of a disappointment was the Eveready version, which was the titanium one, which, like, these batteries are a lot more expensive than the standard alkalines. And you sort of get the idea that, oh, yeah, you know, you're getting this, you know, extra capacity. You might be getting twice the life out of it or something. Like, well, it's not anything like that. You might get an extra 10 or 15, 20% or so. But you're paying, you know, that extra margin in price. And once again, when you actually work it out, when you do the tests, it ends up being much the same dollar per hour rating, you know, very, very similar. The one that I thought was really interesting, and there has been some talk about this recently, apparently, is things like the Rocket Alkaline is... it's very good value for money. That was probably of the top ranking as far as if you were for price comparison and so forth for the sorts of batteries that you could buy as a pair.
Yep.
And the one that really shone out was these things that you get from Dick Smith, the bulk pack Digitor things.
Really?
Yeah, they were quite amazing.
Are they the top of your list? Is that one of the best value for money?
They have been. It's not really a fair comparison because in a dollar per hour rating, they work out where others will work out around a dollar. They end up being about 39 cents. But
And that's because you bought them in a 24-pack or 40-pack.
Yeah, it's a 40-pack, I think it was.
Okay,
yeah.
So the
economy of scale there. I think we'll take a break and we'll be back in just a moment. We were talking to Brian Ackley about batteries, and we'll talk about rechargeables versus non-rechargeables after this.
Listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Have you heard something on Tech Talk Radio worth talking about? Are you looking to share your technical dilemmas or opinions with like-minded Tech Talk Radio listeners? Well, now you can. Introducing the Tech Talk Radio web forum. Visit forum.techtalkradio.com.au and join our community. It's free and on a web browser near you. The Panel on Tech Talk Radio.
And welcome back to the studio, Tech Talk Radio. Andrew McComb here with Dr. Ron Mark Diggins, and our guest this evening is Brian Ackley. We're talking all about batteries, lithium batteries, carbon batteries, you name it, rechargeables, non-rechargeables. And one thing before we went to the break we were going to talk about was the cost per dollar on lithiums and how the lithiums fared up in the big picture, Brian.
Yeah, the lithiums were actually quite interesting. And the application that I was trying them out in, considering that their initial cost, you'd sort of get the idea that these would have to be a real good performer and so forth, have to be really worth the money. Why are they so expensive? Well, as it turns out, where you'd get, in this particular application that I was looking at, where you'd get, say, about 3 hours out of a standard alkaline, you get about 12 odd hours out of the lithium. So they actually were very, they looked like they're very good value for money as far as replacement. You didn't need to replace them anywhere near as often. But their actual cost per hour still ended up being much the same as the alkalines, really, in this particular application. Where they're really good is they keep the same voltage throughout their whole life, whereas the alkalines tend to drop.
So you didn't really gain anything in the cost per hour, but what you did gain was the convenience of not having to change them four times in that same amount of period.
Because one of the main things with batteries is, as you just alluded to there, Brian, was maintaining the voltage, because the voltage is sort of like the water pressure in the battery side of things to keep the right pressure onto the device that you
That's
need.
That's right, yeah.
And I guess... when it came to maintaining voltage over time, did any one particular battery stand out, or did some? Because a lot of them sort of like disappear off gradually or slowly,
yes,
and some fall away really quickly. So,
anything
stand out in that part of the test?
Well, the ones that fall away very quickly are the so called heavy duty batteries.
It's bizarre how they call them heavy duty batteries when that happens.
I think it's at the time when they maybe invented, they were probably the heaviest duty thing they had.
It was probably named back 20 years ago or something
exactly
like that.
That's exactly right, yeah. Alkalines fall away, probably maintain their voltage a lot better, but they do tend to fall off gradually. They only maintain their 1.5 volts for the very very early in their life, and they fall away very quickly after that. And to the point where when they're classed as flat, they're about half their voltage when they really plummet. They're not really usable at that voltage. But the interesting thing is the lithium stays head and shoulders above them all. It's the one that maintains the highest voltage throughout its lifetime. But the other one that also, and I'm sure there's probably people out there are probably saying, what about rechargeable batteries? I mean, how do they fare? It's a sort of a well-known thing amongst technical people that the rechargeable nickel cadmium and nickel hydride type batteries.
Well, NiCads were the first ones out there. We were talking in the break there about we all had NiCads when we and they had that thing called the memory effect of all things.
Yeah, well, there's a bit of controversy about that as to whether it's actually real or not.
It was like the only consumable rechargeable battery for a long time, wasn't it? Obviously, you had like car battery technology and gel cells and things like
that's
that.
Right,
but if you wanted to put a battery into an electronic device, you had NiCad and that was it, wasn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. The NiCad, you're going to see them pretty much disappear. And a lot of people probably think, oh, that's because nickel hydride is so much better. I mean, you know, they've gone in some pretty big strides as far as their capacities is concerned with the nickel hydrides. The European Union legislated in the start of this month, actually, that cadmium was no longer allowed to be used in consumer products, essentially. Well, in just about all products, unless you've got a particular reason for why you have to have an exemption.
I'd have to find out why. Like, is it carcinogenic or something? Or
it's to do with a thing called ROHS, which is Restriction of Hazardous Substances, which is to do with recycling of electronic goods, like things like...
Okay, so it doesn't recycle well.
Yeah, that's right.
And polluting the atmosphere. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Brian, while we're talking about the new nickel metal hydride technology, with the old NiCad batteries, we used to have a phenomenon called like a memory effect. And everyone who used those sorts of batteries knew that you often had to discharge them completely before you recharge them. Otherwise, you shortened the life of them.
That's what they say to you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, is that still the case with nickel metal hydride?
Or? It's reportedly not the case with nickel hydrides. I've yet to actually do some tests on this. This is gonna something that I will.
But they must eventually wear out. Surely
they do. You supposedly. Well, I mean. NiCads used to say you can get up to 1,000 uses. Well, depends on how you use them, how heavily you drain them.
I'd like to find the person who actually got 1,000 uses.
Yeah, well, this is one of the things I'd like to do a test of eventually one day, but you know, it's going to take some time to get around to. The nickel hydrides supposedly don't have this memory effect. You can partially discharge and partially recharge them, and it's supposed to. They're not supposed to suffer the same problems.
Okay. Are there any batteries in the rechargeable side of things which stand out apart from others, or are they all pretty much made of the same material, aren't they? They're all. You really look when you're buying a rechargeable, you're looking at your milliamp hours as a rating and how long they last as he holds up a graph to me, and we'll talk about these graphs shortly too.
Sorry, it was a bit how long they last as far as recharging them.
Well, if you're looking for a rechargeable battery, one of your buying criteria should be obviously the larger number on the side. If it's a 2,000 milliamp hour battery or 2.5 hours, that's really your only buying criteria, isn't it?
Yeah, basically. Well, I mean, it comes down to price. You know, I mean, the higher capacity ones, of course, they charge more for them. One of the things that you've got to be aware of, though, with the nickel hydride batteries, in all of these, like nickel hydride and nickel cadmium, is that they don't have a very good shelf life. They will die very quickly. You can't expect to use them in something that you want to use for a year and then recharge the battery. They're only really good for day-to-day use devices because after about a month they lose, I've forgotten what the percentage is, but something in the order of about 40% of their capacity. Whereas alkalines, lithiums and so forth, you can leave them on the shelf for years and they'll still be quite usable.
Just tell us about your interesting experiment with your storage life, just quickly.
Yeah, well, when it comes to, I mean, that's one of the things, like with these, I only really did this test on alkalines because I was curious about what would happen. One of the things that happened was my mother used to always store her batteries in the fridge, and I used to think that was quite strange. Why
with the film, hey?
I was about to say, along with the
old Kodak 200.
Well, she was into photography too, so she used to do this. She had this
it was all together, that's why.
It was all together, and the one shelf on the fridge was the batteries and the film and all that sort of stuff. But anyway, I thought...
Heaven help someone raiding the fridge at night.
Yes. So I thought, well, I'll do some tests anyway. And what I did is I took a set of batteries, they were the standard Eveready Energizers. And I put one set in the just stored them at room temperature. I stored another set in the fridge, another set in the freezer for 12 months, and I got another set that I put in the temperature chamber at work, where we cycled them daily from minus 20 to plus 70 degrees twice a day.
Oh, that'd get you going, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and they were the idea was to simulate what would happen if you left the batteries in the car. Taken to the extreme, I guess.
Yes,
exactly.
From the snow to the desert.
From the snow.
Pop them in the Mars lander. Do they use energy ever ready?
My expectation would be that they would be completely unusable. They would all...
That's what you would expect. Yeah. The interesting thing was when I finally got the batteries out after 12 months, the plastic on the outside, the label had split down the side of both batteries, and I thought they hadn't leaked, but I thought, oh, these are going to be just completely dead by the time I put them in there. Well, the interesting thing was that they only showed a very slight decrease in discharge as far as, like, they certainly died quicker under discharge than the ones that had been stored at room temperature or in the fridge or freezer. But the interesting thing was that the ones that had been frozen or refrigerated performed much the same as far as their discharge curve was concerned as the one that had been stored at room temperature. So
how about that?
It was quite amazing, which basically means that there's no real... If you're only going to store them for a year or so, there is no real
advantage.
Don't
put them in the fridge.
There's no point. You might get a slight advantage, but you're never going to see it.
So you've busted an urban myth for us.
Busted an urban
myth. Fantastic. That's what it's all about. Now, we have to wrap up, boys. A quick question, Brian, before we go. If you were walking into the shop and you wanted to buy some batteries for the torch or something like that, what would you buy? Lithium?
No, not for the torch. I'd just buy alkaline.
Okay. So your generic alkalines for the torch?
Yeah.
What about for the digital camera?
It depends, I guess, whether it's an older, very power-hungry one, in which case you probably have to buy lithiums because you probably just won't get a usable... You won't be able to get through the life of the, a day's use of the camera otherwise. But a lot of the newer ones, I mean, power drain is starting to drop off a bit with those, and you're starting to get a lot more efficient.
And I find with my camera, I have nickel metal hydrides in my camera, and I find that by the time I go to use
they're
it 3 weeks...
Ones.
Yep, the rechargeable ones. Yeah. By the time I go to use it 3 weeks later, like Brian was saying, they could be 40% flat, so I only get a few shots out of it before the battery indicator comes up, and then I'm dead. So,
but as far as value is concerned, I would say the nickel hydrides, if the camera can take them, can handle a lower voltage, then definitely they would be the way to go. They would work out to be the most cost efficient.
Thank you very much, Brian, for coming
in
and sharing that information with us. If you've got any questions, anything like that, feel free to send us an email at feedback@techtalkradio.com.au about batteries, and we'll forward them on to Brian.
You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
Adam Turner's View from the Couch on Tech Talk Radio.
Everyone loves an underdog, so there was understandable outrage last year when Pluto was declared not to be a planet. But now everyone's favourite lump of ice has suffered even further indignity. Rather than being the littlest planet, Pluto was last year declared the biggest dwarf planet. But now it's even been stripped of this dubious title. A hunk of rock beyond Neptune called 2003 UB313, or Eris to its friends, has been declared a smidgen bigger than Pluto. Eris even has its own moon, so now it's officially pushed Pluto even further down the list. Pluto was the last of the traditional planets to be discovered, spotted in 1930 by American Clyde Tombaugh as a dim speck moving amongst the stars. It's 6 times smaller than the Earth, and it's even smaller than many of the solar system's moons. It lives amongst a cloud of asteroids known as the Kuiper Belt, and it doesn't even orbit on the same plane as the other planets. Sometimes it's further away from us than Neptune, sometimes it's closer. Clearly, it's the black sheep of the family. Even so, there was an uproar last year when the International Astronomical Union voted to demote Pluto, but the fight to restore the object's honour rages on. PlutoPetition.com is leading the charge, running an online poll to see if people want Pluto restored to its former glory. After 1 million votes, they intend to submit the results to the International Astronomical Union, but so far it's only 13,000 people who have voted to let Pluto back into the family, with 3,000 voting against. Things look dim for the former ninth planet, as other larger objects will certainly be discovered to push poor Pluto even further down the food chain. The International Astronomical Union will reconvene in 2 years, which is the earliest point at which Pluto's status can be revisited. What Pluto needs is a good PR campaign. If only it had a redeeming feature. I mean, it doesn't have Jupiter's spot or Saturn's rings. Perhaps it could pitch itself as the ultimate holiday destination to really get away from it all. Rest assured, you haven't heard the last of this tiny planet with a big heart. Will the fight for Pluto's honour rage on? You bet your anus it will.
Entertaining, informative and independent. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio.
And that brings us to the end, not only of this week's show, but also of the Tech Talk Radio Summer Series for this year. Next week at this time, we'll have the first episode of the new 2008 series of Tech Talk Radio. Andrew will be back to host the show, the panel will be live in the studio, and some of your favourite segments will return, including the Odd Spot, website and gadget of the week. Don't forget, if you have anything you want to tell us about, you can call the feedback line on 1300 664 882 or go to the website at techtalkradio.com.au to find all the ways you can contact us. So tune in next week on this very radio station or via the live stream or the podcast for a shiny new Tech Talk Radio. I'm Graham Callaghan. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Tech Talk Radio, brought to you each and every week by a group of dedicated professionals from within the media, broadcasting, IT and telecommunications industries. The team consists of executive producer Andrew McComb, producer Dr. Ron Panelis, Graham Callaghan and Mark Diggins, expert opinion Adam Turner, and our US correspondent is Lydia Davis. Post-production facilities courtesy of Evolving Communications. Podcast production by Graham Callaghan. Tech Talk Radio is broadcast, recorded and streamed live to the world each and every Monday night at 8 p.m. from the studios of 3WBC. The crew wish to thank all the stations that take the show, including 3WBC and 3XX in Melbourne, Cairns FM, Switch 1197 in Brisbane, 95.3 Huon FM in Tasmania, Queer FM in WA, and Stop and Go Radio in the United States. For sponsorship and advertising, call 03 9018 9043 or visit our website, techtalkradio.com.au. This has been a production of Tech Talk Radio Vic and is subject to copyright and applicable laws and may not be rebroadcast without approval.